Okay. Anyone want to expand on that? Yeah. Okay, there's probably one thing that's missing. It's actually designed not just for documents, but for office application format. So it includes the spreadsheet, PowerPoint style and so on. So that was a good guess. If you lose them, come and get it some after. Anyone know what ISO number was given? 26300. Yes, it's now ISO standard.
By the time it's finished, I won't need to do any more at all.
That's okay, I'll give you a badge too. Okay, and I suppose we should mention Microsoft at some point. Who knows what the official title is for Microsoft's submission to standards organisation?
This week.
That's a hard one. No one wants to guess that one. No, not RTF. Yeah.
There's a bit missing off the front, though.
But they're actually looking at going through a few different organisations, but ECMO's the organisation they're going through. The format's actually changed names slightly recently, so OpenXML is probably the closest. So I won't throw the badge up that far. I'll leave that there for later on. So is our audio ready to go?
Yeah.
Or recording? Okay, that's good. Looks like we've got people here to start. So I'd just like to welcome everyone along to the MediConf. For those who may not know, I'm actually the marketing contact for Open Office in Australia, having taken over from Jacqueline recently, who has stepped down from that position for various reasons. So any contact that you need to make in regards to what's happening or you want some publicity on a project you're working with Open Office, let me know. We'll be able to help you in that regard, both in Australia, and if it's more suitable for overseas, we can put you in touch with the right people there as well. Today we have a number of talks organised, starting with Michael. They're all related to Open Office in some way, which is obviously a good thing. We have a couple of sessions where we're doing a Q&A and demonstrations. Now, in the past, usually we've just done Q&A, but we're doing some demonstrations this year because we have some really cool geeky stuff to show you. We've got Bill Robertson here from Devoutly Wine, who's an avid user of Open Office, and he's bringing some stuff along to show us there, including an ODF viewer on his mobile phone. So if anyone's interested in that sort of thing, you'll see some of the technologies that will be coming out shortly. So along with the other Q&A stuff, we've got two sessions, one in the morning and one late in the afternoon. In the morning, we'll have the demonstrations, and if you have any questions that you already know off the top of your head that you really must have solved today for work or just to relieve torment on your soul, we'll cover that in the first session. In the second session, if you come up with any other ideas or maybe we weren't able to answer some of the questions in the first session, we'll research those and follow up with those in the afternoon session. Also, if there's some part of Open Office that you're not familiar with and would have liked to have seen a talk on, please also suggest that in the first Q&A session, because we do have other presentations, both for previous conferences, that we could actually present if you were interested in those as well as part of the Q&A sessions. So I'd like to welcome everyone along today, and our first speaker is Michael. I'll let him give you a bit of background as he gets into his talk, and hope you all enjoy today.
Thanks for that. Thanks very much. As you know, my name is Michael Carden. I work for the National Archives of Australia, where I'm called the Preservation Software Manager. And that means that I guide a small team of software developers and testers who create software for digital preservation. And I'm going to explain a little bit about what that means, One distinction I'd like to make is anybody who's looked at the program and noticed that I'm giving a talk about digital preservation in the conference tomorrow, this is a different talk. So today here I'm going to focus on the aspects of what we do that have some fairly direct bearing on Open Document Format, Open Office. Tomorrow I'll be talking about the broader digital preservation as a whole. So it is two different things. I have here Andrew Keeling, who's a senior software developer, sitting down in the corner here. So any hardcore Java heads who are into Java software development, he's the man who makes it happen. I'd like to give a warning about jargon busting. Can you all please be aware of busting me if I use jargon, whether it be computer jargon, particularly archival jargon, because it's pretty well not known outside of archival circles. I've worked for the archives for enough years now that some of it started to seep in, and I can't get rid of it. So I find myself talking like a record keeper sometimes. Andy will smack me if I do, but please, all of you, pull me up if I do any jargon busting, any jargon. Also, questions. As I'm going through stuff, if something comes up in your mind, ask me. Take this where it wants to go for you at the time when I'm saying things. If I'm not making something clear or if it just brings something up, ask me at the time. I've got plenty of time to be able to take that as we go. Okay, I'll set a bit of context for you first. What does your National Archives do? What do? We keep all these things in their traditional analog formats, and we get them from Commonwealth government agencies. We get them from Commonwealth persons like Governors General and Ministers, Prime Ministers particularly. We get them from military units. We get them from the ABC and SBS. We get them from the personal records of people who are just determined by the Commonwealth as having significance. And we also have some intelligence agencies. And things like Royal Commissions all end up with the National Archives. So this stuff the National Archives has been doing for a long time. Principally looking after paper is a big part of it. Images are another huge thing. We actually currently have just over 17 million images online. 17 million is an awful lot of images when you consider that nearly all of those originated in a paper form and somebody scanned or photographed them. We have links with Picture Australia, so a lot of our stuff is accessible via Picture Australia as a portal to our web services that make them available. But in world archival terms, 17 million images is actually pretty big. Australia's sort of punching above its weight with that kind of thing. That's a lot of data online. The collection that we actually have of all these records is vast. In fact, it's so vast that only 15% of the collection is known. So there's that 85% of the collection that's not known. Sure, we know that it came from such and such agency in such and such a year. It was concerned with something or other, but the details of what's in all that is just not known. And in fact, the task of finding out all that in detail will never happen. It can't be completed. It's the old, you need an infinite number of monkeys with an infinite number of typewriters kind of thing. You would never be able to make it happen. So a lot of this stuff happens on a demand basis. A researcher or an agency or sometimes just individuals in the community are interested in finding out about something. They ask the National Archives. The National Archives goes and finds the records and makes them available. And in fact, there's a service that I didn't know existed until I worked for the National Archives where each and every one of us gets 5 goes a year at asking the National Archives to make some record available, scan it, photograph it, and put it online. And the classic example for most people is that many, many people have relatives who served in one of the World Wars. So I know my grandfather was in World War II. I came along and went to the National Archives website, put in a request for his military records, and up they pop online for me, free of charge. So the archives goes and gets that, does the scanning, photographing, makes it available. We can all do that. And that's a service that's made available by the archives at no charge at the moment. So we have all these things. And these are all the things that we have to look after effectively in perpetuity. The advent of digital equivalents for pretty much all of them, with the possible exception of textiles, means that... that's going to be a big preservation issue when we have to get the second life. All these things have an analogue in the digital world. Analogue is probably an unfortunate name to use there. But they have an equivalent in the digital world. These things are originating now in a digital form. And we have the same responsibility to look after those things into the far future that we have with the traditional types of things. We have a lot of records. That's an unremarkable looking thing, but it's remarkable for a couple of reasons. It's a briefcase. It belonged to a former Australian Prime Minister. That's a photograph of it, obviously, but what's interesting about it is that that's an artefact. We actually have the physical briefcase. And as an archive, we don't normally look after artefacts. We look after records. This one happens to be a record because it belonged to Harold Holt. And Harold Holt was the Australian Prime Minister in 1966 and 1967, and he went swimming at Cheviot Beach in Victoria one day and never came back. Has anyone been to Cheviot Beach? Anyone been spearfishing at Cheviot Beach? That is great. How many countries would have a swimming pool named after a dead prime minister who drowned? Who potentially drowned? If you don't think he was picked up by a Chinese submarine or a Russian submarine, or UFOs. Only last year, the National Archives actually published a book about Harold Holt to attempt to finally put to rest the UFO rumours. But I think they will persist indefinitely. But Cheviot Beach is an awesome place to go, particularly spearfishing and a bit of scuba diving too. But it's viciously dangerous, and what he was thinking, I can't imagine. But he disappeared. He might have been. But his briefcase is quite cool because he goes up his briefcase and there's all this amazing stuff in it. The man was a very interesting person. There were 7 sleeping masks in there. 7, one for every day of the week, sleeping masks. There was enough aspirin to kill a horse. There was a couple of government publications, actually government records, documents that he was dealing with at the time, but his personal grooming stuff that was amazing. He had combs and brushes and hair stuff, that, you know, the bull cream type of stuff, all in his briefcase when he went missing. So it tells a very interesting story about the kind of guy, very odd guy from what I can tell, that he was when he disappeared. But that's an unusual thing for the National Archives to hang on to because it's an actual artifact. The other sorts of things that we have, computers. You can do a search for images again in our image search. This brings up something about the National Archives that you're probably familiar with, is that we have stuff that we sit on for 30 years. The rule of thumb for the archives is nearly everything we get, no matter what it is, falls under legislation that says that we keep it under lock and key for 30 years. I'm sure most of you are familiar with what happens on the 1st of January every year on New Year's Day. The news programs all run the stories about the annual cabinet release from the National Archives. It's made available for everyone to see what happened 30 years ago. So this year there was the cool stuff about the assassination plot for Bob Hawke, the government anti-terrorist stuff that was being set up, the initial times of the Fraser government. So all that stuff gets released at the 1st of January every year. These old computers, these images just get sat on until we get past the 30-year limit and we bring them out. So I did a bit of a search on our photo search service, which we all have access to online, every one of us, and pulled out some of these computers. And there was an obsession back then with telecom, as it was in its pre-Telstra days, with all these telephone-equipped computers. And here is my current favourite. In 1910, the Australian Defence Department ran a competition to design what would be the forerunner of a joint strike fighter. This had to be a military aircraft capable of hovering in place. A chap by the name of W. Paris Meyer came up with that brilliant, brilliant design. And that was his entry into the competition. He could have won £5,000 had he had the best design. £5,000 in 1910 would have been a pretty penny. It's probably not the billions that would go into a strike fighter now, but still quite impressive. And unfortunately, I have to tell you, he didn't win. Nobody won. Unfortunately, this was one of the best of the entries that were available in 1910. And this was entered just after, was it the Sikorskys who got the first hovering action in a helicopter for a very short while? It was about 8 seconds or something. They'd done that some months before this guy came up with this thing. So he wasn't quite in touch with modern aerodynamics at the time. He had a little bit of a ways to go, but I still think it's beautiful. We've sat down poring over this trying to work out what would actually connect to what and how would that actually work. I don't think Mr. Myers had any idea either. Okay, so if you want to play that game of go and find stuff from the National Archives, that's what our website currently looks like, and the search links are down the bottom there for photo search and record search. Photo search is your gateway to those 17 million images. Record search is towards our text-based stuff, and there's an awful lot of stuff there. It's huge. Okay, digital preservation. We've got to take stuff that comes from these Commonwealth agencies and look after it the same way as we look after that analog stuff and look after it into the very far future. If we take a piece of paper, like that competition entry, and we stick it in a dark, environmentally controlled room on a shelf out of the way, and we don't disturb it, we don't set fire to it, in 100 years, there's an excellent chance that we can pluck it off the shelf and realise that it's the design for a strike fighter, potentially. We can look at it and we know that we can make some sense of it. We have some understanding. If it's text, we can probably read it. If it's got pictures in it, we can probably understand what the pictures are. So we can take a piece of paper, we can do that, we can leave it for 100 years, we come back, it's still perfectly usable. In digital terms, this just isn't true. In digital terms, you must intervene. You've got to take some positive action, or else the information will not be there in the future. So the strategy that the National Archives is pursuing revolves very heavily around standards and around open formats. Our software development's core is to take any arbitrary file type or format from anybody who's sending it to the National Archives, convert that file format into an openly specified format, and then we keep it. We keep the original that we were sent wrapped in a bit of metadata. We keep the open version wrapped into metadata, and the process of doing all of this, in fact, the process that commences with getting the stuff in and then every step along the way through looking after it, generates its own metadata, preservation metadata. So we get metadata that tells us it was Michael that copied that in. It was Andy that checked the checksums. It was somebody else who did this, et cetera, et cetera. So we have an audit trail that tells us at every step of the way what's happened. And all of this information gets stored. So you can imagine that for even the most trivial text file, you can end up with quite a lot of metadata. And we do. Metadata is kind of the bread and butter of digital preservation. It's all about the metadata. Without the metadata, the stuff is meaningless. There's a lot of philosophical debates in archives about what constitutes a record, but one of the most important things that everybody agrees on is that without metadata, you don't have one. So speaking... Yeah, sure. It's potentially a huge amount of data, yeah. Actually, that brings up the difficult... I'll answer that in a second, but I'll bring up the difficult question of how do you even find out how much is there? But key to us is how much storage do we buy? So we go to all the Commonwealth government agencies and we say, how much have you got? And they say, we don't know. We've had responses ranging from, we don't have any at all. And we said to those people, hang on, you guys, do you have desktop computers? And they said, oh, yes, we've got desktop computers. Oh, good. Do you send and receive email? Oh, yes, we couldn't live without email. Do you create documents in a word processor? Yes, we've got that. But you have no electronic records? No, none whatsoever. Yeah. For people familiar with ACT politics, was it? Ros Kelly, the whiteboard principle? You write on the whiteboard, wipe it off, and it never happened. So the issue of what's out there is a big one. We can't get a handle on it. The other extreme is when they said 300 terabytes. And that was a true estimate. Luckily, they didn't give that to us. That's one of the scary ones. That's the one that Geoscience Australia have got, all the remote sensing data. Geoscience Australia rock, in my opinion. They've had a working digital archive since the 1970s. And their working digital archive still makes accessible to them the stuff that they recorded in the late 1970s. And that's awesome. They've done a great job. And I sincerely hope they keep looking after it. And I sincerely hope it never becomes our problem. It's huge. So finding out what people have is a big challenge. Once we get it, we store it in our physical infrastructure, which I'll probably talk a bit more about tomorrow. It's a little bit off beam for here, but it's all RAID, all on RAID arrays, big ones, different ones from different manufacturers. Redundancy is very important to us, so we won't buy two things from the same manufacturer. If you see, we have one technology of RAID storage over here from one vendor and one technology over here from another vendor. And if they've sold us some RAID storage, they can't sell us servers. One OS over here, one OS over here, one file system over here, one file system over here. Redundancy at every level we can bring in. So the only storage we currently trust is spinning disk, so it's RAID arrays. But part of what we do and part of the core activities that we engage in is technology watch. We're always looking out for what's being developed, what's reliable, what we need to move to next. That's quite important. Yeah. No. We theoretically don't use tape at all. In practice right now, we are using a little. Tape has usefulness to us at the small scale, and we are currently in the small scale. We're operational. We're doing what we do of preserving stuff, but we don't have government agencies beating a path to our door saying, please take these records, because most of them don't know what they've got. So it's a slow trickle coming in the door, which suits us fine, actually, because it means we can scale nicely and hope it's not too logarithmic when it takes off. But tape is good when the volumes are relatively small. Our vision for, and the volumes get much bigger than they are now, and the way we've designed our infrastructure and built it right now, our two isolated digital repositories live on a fibre channel backbone. So we could arguably put one in Sydney and one in Canberra, for example, and they would carry the same content, and that would be the backup. So a cross fibre channel from RAID to RAID is probably the only practical thing, because your windows get increasingly bigger and bigger and bigger and impractical as the terabytes grow. so we don't go so much for tape. Tape also we've had some issues with because we use tape sometimes when we do big, huge volume data scanning projects where we'll scan a whole lot of A0 plans at high resolution and they create enormous amounts of data. And to move those around from place to place, they often get moved on high-density tape like LTO and SDLT tapes. Those tapes are great for what they're designed for, which is to back up a machine, and when the machine has a problem, you put the tape back into the machine and bring it up. If you use the tape to take it to another machine, you've a bit of a lottery. Toss a coin, roll the dice, will it read or won't it read? Because the higher the density is getting the tapes, the more susceptible they are to the tiniest misalignment in the drives between two tapes. So same model drive, same manufacturer of drive, same batch of drive. This one's a micro fart out of alignment with respect to this one, and you start losing data. And we found that in practical terms, so we don't use those for moving stuff around anymore. That's true, and also you've then got to have more issues about how did I store that tape in the meantime, what was the environment it was in if you're going to take time, and that sort of thing. So tape is, we sort of try and stay away from it. Okay, so it's open formats, which are based on open standards. Back in 2003, the National Archives was involved with OASIS, which is the Organisation for Advancement of Structured Information Systems. And OASIS had a technical committee working on the development of the format of open document format. And we had one of our colleagues at the time, Simon Davis, was sitting in on that and putting the archives perspective to the development of open document format. And having it community developed with every interested party looking at it and no single driver for it was very important as far as we were concerned. And that there should be, when the thing goes live, multiple implementations of it. And we actually didn't start using open document format for anything until after it did start getting used out there in things like KOffice and OpenOffice, ObiWord, etc. And licensing constraints are another issue. We don't want to find out that we've stored something that some years from now someone says, oh, by the way, we own the license to that format. Pay us if you're going to use it. That's a real worry. Hopefully we can outlive them, though, because we talk in 50, 100, 500-year increments. We were recently worried a little bit about fonts, that you know we could be embedding fonts that in documents that people unintentionally embedded that somebody else owns the IP for, and what happens when you render that font down the track. We mostly don't have to worry because we outlive them, which is cool. Most fonts are... because before we released most of our stuff, 30 years have gone past, and most of the IP on fonts is gone, so that's pretty cool. So that's a good strategy if all else fails in the archives world. You can outlast them. Just keep on going. So open formats are the core of what we're doing. All right. Open formats are very, very important. Here's some examples of open formats, and I guess this is very much preaching to the converted. Everybody here, I suspect, is familiar with most of those now. Our software that we use to do our open format conversions supports all of these, outputs data in all of these currently. We also output data in JPEG, which you're all aware is now truly free, open. Forgent Networks have pulled their head in after the USPTO said, no, you cannot sue people because you think you own JPEG. They don't, so JPEG's open, which is good. Which means that if we get a JPEG, we won't try and turn it into anything else. We'll just keep it as it is. Otherwise, we'll try and default to putting stuff into PNG if it's an image format. And we've just got FLAC there for audio. Audio and video are a big, interesting, scary area. FLAC we're using now, and we have an implementation for FLAC that's working nicely. Although it would be nice if somebody would go out and do some good Java work in FLAC. All our software development is in Java, which originated for the need to go cross-platform, deploy it anywhere. Not for any particular religious convictions about Java, which Andy may have, but well, the rest of us certainly don't. But video is going to be a real challenge because video and metadata and finding a neutral format for video is going to be tricky, and that's something we're working on this year. There are a lot of big dumps of video data, including our own. We have a huge repository here in Sydney, backing onto the Villawood Detention Centre, actually. This massive, massive warehouse of audio and video. It's gigantic, and it's all being done in proprietary formats. And they're doing telecine work where they take stuff off off film, put it to video, but a lot of it's been proprietary, so we're working on how we deal with that. Ideally, it would be good to be able to do conversion to an open format at the start, rather than feed it all to us after they've done some work and we do it all again, which I think would be crazy. But video is quite hard because there are so many vested interests. We have to make the ABC, SBS, the National Film and Sound Archive and the Parliamentary Library Service all happy with whatever we do, which is going to be a political nightmare. But no doubt we'll solve that this year. Which brings us to our friend Open Document Format, ISO 26300 as we heard before. Today's the day for voting, by the way. Does everybody know about that? Today's the day that voting starts on for OASIS members on version 1.1 of the format. It's got declared open, and I just got an email this morning that tells me that I've got to read the whole format document and comment on it by the end of the week, which is going to be... So anybody who wants to give me a quick pricey of the format document, I've downloaded it to my laptop and once again just started dribbling when I started reading through it. Fortunately, the appendices do tend to say, here's what we changed since last time, so that kind of helps. Thanks to opendocumentfellowship.org and Pete Harlow in particular for this beautiful piece of logo design work. That's the downloadable wallpaper from opendocumentfellowship.org. I expect sometime during the Open Office mini-conf somebody's going to talk about the fellowship, are they? I hope. If you haven't heard of the Open Document Fellowship, it's a wonderful website and a great bunch of people doing development work around Open Office, Open Document Format. It happens that there are people who are involved with Open Office and KOffice and other things to do with the format on their website and on their mailing lists. The website is an awesome resource. If somebody ever says, what's this Open Document Format thing, opendocumentfellowship.org is a fantastic link to point people at to get them educated about it. Okay, now to what we do, the Xena software. Xena is our core software product. Xena stands for XML, Electronic Normalizing for Archives. And it's been in development for a few years. Year before last year, we radically redesigned it to make it into a software framework so that it's not really designed to be a desktop application to do anything. It's designed to be a software framework that sits behind other workflows, other applications, to do the heavy lifting work for digital preservation of file format conversions. So we can deploy it in other places, other than the National Archives' particular environment. It's also available as a desktop thing that you can download, you can play with, you can use to do conversions, but it's not principally designed that way. Really, we make the downloadable Xena available to show people what this conversion bizzo is all about anyway, so you can get some handle on what it's doing. These are the things that Xena is all about. It determines file formats. More on that in a moment. It converts to open formats, obviously. It has a plug-in architecture which lets us plug in custom metadata wrappers. So, for example, we're a National Archives. We have particular metadata that we care about that we want to be embedded with our records. But if we were, say, the National Library, they would have different metadata, for example, ISBNs, so with books. Logical. So everything's pluggable about Xena. We also have custom output file namers so that when it's done its work and converted to an open format, you can customise the way it names the file that it spits out. We do some crazy stuff ourselves. We create a hash, which just looks like a big string of garbage, .xena, to tell us, because we have some strange requirements for the way we store it. But principally, it's all pluggable, so you can have whatever you want the file name to look like on the output side available through a custom file namer. The plugin architecture extends to all the components that make it possible to do file format conversions. So for each genre, if you like, of file formats, we have a plugin, and the plugin is called a normalizer plugin in our jargon, normalizing being converting to the archival format. And the normalizer plugins do part of the work of the file format identification, and they do the conversion, and they help us with the rendering afterwards if we want to take a look at what we did. So the plugin part means that as new formats come along, we write another normalizer for the new format, plug it into Xena, and away we go. We can deal with stuff as it changes. The plugin for Office documents is mostly OpenOffice. And using OpenOffice in that sense is a little bit like using the space shuttle as a plugin to a mini miner. It's a behemoth. And if we could strip out really just the bits that handle the Microsoft Office format, import filters, and some export to probably ODF and PDF, we would be very happy campers if we didn't have to have all the rest of it. So effectively what happens for us is when we use it in that sense, we have OpenOffice sitting there in the background, effectively running like a daemon running on a port, and we just send it stuff and say, give us back this in ODF, and it comes back. But it's this monster sitting there working for us, whereas our software is just this little pimple on its backside. Whereas some of the other things that we use for doing some of our other plugins are significantly smaller. Some of them are developed in-house, and wherever possible, we try not to reinvent the wheel. If somebody has a GPL'd file format conversion for something that recognises some type of file we want and gives us some type of output we want, that's awesome. We're happy to include GPL code and we try to just make Xena the framework that lets all that stuff hang together. Okay. File format determination, I guess I should comment on that briefly. We thought file format determination was a problem that we just worked out because we had to know what stuff was before we could do stuff with it, and we thought it wasn't too important, we just did it. And then as time's gone by, we've discovered that it excites people, particularly in digital preservation and archives land, to the extent that all around the world people are working and struggling with this problem of file format determination. And it's not actually easy to look at a file and tell what it is. It is a kind of a tricky thing. If you come from a Windows world, you're probably accustomed to looking at the extension, the .doc, tells you it's a Microsoft Word file, okay? Most people think that's about the only way you can tell what a file is. Unfortunately, it's not that reliable. If somebody happens to leave the .doc off, you're in a little bit of a quandary as to what the file is. So we worked out a way of doing this, and the Xena software does it. Basically, the rundown is that each file is passed by all the normalizers, and the normalizers all have a look at it and say, I reckon it's me. It's mine. I recognize that file type. It's good. I'll give it a score of 75. I reckon it's mine. The next one looks at it and says, I ain't never heard of this before. It's a minus 10,000. Take it away. And the next one says, oh, it's pretty good. I think it's a fair chance. Yeah, I could deal with that. I'll give it a 50. So we built this, and we tweaked those sort of values that we get back from the normalizer, and I thought, that's got to be so fragile. No way, you know, this can't work. Turns out it's unbelievably accurate. And it's bloody hard to fool. So we do things like we feed it, you know, files with and without extensions. We feed it files with and without magic numbers. People from a Linux background will know magic numbers, the first two bytes of a file. Tell you what the file format is in an ideal world, in a utopia where people actually do that. That would be wonderful. Or where some software companies tend to give the same two bytes to a whole range of very, very different file formats. No names, no pack drill, but that happens sometimes. So you've got to be able to look at a whole lot of different facets of it to work out what it is and score it. And the normalizers do this for us. They give us back a score, and we see who bid the best, and we say, yeah, we reckon it's yours. Take it away. This works spectacularly well. You can try this yourself. You can download it and throw files at it and try and break it. Please, when and if you do break it, let us know so we can make it better than it is now. But in a typical real-world transfer of data from a government organisation which had a dozen odd file types, over 5,000 individual files, individual data objects, there were three that we missed, and two of those three were password protected. So we're getting there. It's pretty close. Now, we didn't think much of this until people started making a fuss about their own file format determining projects. And it turns out there's two biggies at the moment. The UK National Archives has one called DROID, Digital Record Identification thingamajig. Now, DROID's backed by a big XML database that they keep updating, the PRONOM database, which is updated regularly with all information about file types. And it interrogates that database to try and work out what a file is. Turns out if you just change the extension from .csv to .doc or something, it just says, well, it must be a .doc. It's still a CSV, sorry. So it's unfortunately trivially easy to fool. We'd love someone to solve this problem better than we have. I mean, we don't for one moment think we've got it perfect, but we've got a pretty good working way of doing it. So every time someone comes up, we're like, yes, please, let's have a look. So we evaluated that and thought, nah, it doesn't quite work for us. The one that's got me personally most excited at the moment is the Global Digital Format Registry. Anyone heard of that, the GDFR? It's a project in the USA that's funded by the Andrew Mellon Foundation at the Harvard University Library. It's been given, I think it's a couple of million US dollars to go away and design this thing. Now, it's designed a bit like an internet domain name service where you send a query out over the network saying, I've got a file, tell me about it, what is it? And you can get, it's like DNS where you have an authoritative route to the whole thing, and then you have servers scattered around the world that get a bit less and less authoritative as you go further away from the route where things are not as confirmed. And you ask your local server and it will give you back a thing saying, yeah, it's a fair good chance it's this, maybe this, but probably this. And if you want to propagate it back up the tree, you can get a more and more accurate idea of it. And they wrote a paper about this, and I thought, this is fantastic. If they get this working, it's just to send the query off and we don't have to care anymore. It's great. Then I read the bit in their white paper that says, we hope that this service will be so useful that the intellectual property owners of closed formats will give us all their information. And, oh, sort of fell down. I think it falls at that hurdle, but they're supposed to have an implementation available on the web now, actually at the end of last year, and their website's been very quiet since July last year. So I'm sort of waiting with trepidation and hope that they'll solve that problem. Well, people started telling us that this matters, that this file type determination is important, so we're sort of looking at possibly just spinning off that part by itself without the rest of the file, the stuff that happens afterwards. At the moment, it's embedded in what we do, so that once we work out what something is, we then go and do a conversion on it. We don't stop there. But if people really want it, we could do that. All right, so here's what Xena looks like with the Xena registered trademark logo in the middle there. Xena is completely open source and GPL, but the trademark is registered. The Xena sits there, and it just gives you somewhere to plug your metadata wrappers, your output namers, and your normalizers. Imagine a whole pile of normalizers going off into infinity over there. And your digital archiving application sits there and gets Xena to do the work, basically. So some examples of this in the current day. We've integrated Xena successfully with DSpace, and people who are familiar with the institutional repositories used in universities possibly heard of DSpace. DSpace was a MIT and was it Hewlett Packard, I think, joint project, which became open sourced, and a lot of universities use it. We've got a test bed for this at the University of Sydney, Fisher Library at the University of Sydney, where we integrated Xena with DSpace so that in their DSpace repository, they use it as ever. People ingest stuff via a web front end, unknown to the user. There's a Xena conversion happening as well, and the repository is keeping an open format version as well as the thing that they were normally doing. So that's quite interesting to us, that integration. It so happens that a lot of these digital archivy things tend to be written in Java. So integration with Fedora, which is another popular, not to be confused with Fedora Core Linux, but Fedora repository software, integration with that is on our slate for this year. Doesn't look like it'll be a huge task. And currently, the city of Perth is using our software with their records management system. Michael Still's not in the room. He's speaking this afternoon about his book. Michael Still used to work for Tower Software. Tower Software have a record-keeping system called TRIM. It's very, very popular in Commonwealth government. Not popular among the users. As a TRIM user myself and a record keeper, it says it on my job description, I have to be a record keeper. As a TRIM user, now it's not very popular, but it's there for people who have to keep records. The City of Perth have a reseller for TRIM who worked with them, who picked up our Xena software, just using the documentation we make available in the source, which my colleague here documented beautifully. They were able to read that, write their own metadata wrapper and output name specific to their task and integrate it with TRIM for the City of Perth. So now the City of Perth, all their record keeping is being Xenified, if you like, to open formats, mainly because we make our source available and people can play with it. They did that actually without any reference to us. We found out after the fact when they were kind of making an announcement that they'd done it. And we went, "Oh, someone's used it. Excuse me, do you need help with that?" And they went, "No, all done. Yeah, that's good. Thanks for that." We've got to ask them if we can have the joining code between TRIM and Xena back into the tree. Yeah, they have promised that, haven't they? Andy's been talking to the guys at Sigma. They've promised that it's coming in this year. Sooner the better. Okay, so here's how we use Xena. We use Xena to take every data object goes into Xena, and we create those two things: a metadata wrapped original and a metadata wrapped open format version. So that's how we employ it, and we don't employ it through a GUI. Through its own GUI anyway. We employ it through a different software application, which we developed to do that whole capturing all the audit trail stuff that I spoke about earlier, a thing we call a digital preservation recorder. And Xena sits behind the digital preservation recorder doing the work for us. So Xena is open source, and it's easy to build from source if you feel so inclined, mostly only useful because we are doing development well ahead of the binary releases. It's hosted on SourceForge, so it's a free download to anybody, xena.sourceforge.net. The binary is released on whenever someone gives me a kick and says, "Isn't it about time you had a binary now?" We've got a very good stable binary that we released midway through last year, but if you build from source, you'll get some extra stuff that's not in the binary release, notably the audio plugin, which is in a sort of a semi-tested prototypical form. I've used it successfully. But if source is well documented, so on the Xena SourceForge page, it tells you step by step. Even for somebody who probably, if you're not very familiar with using a command line on a computer, you could probably still compile from source if you wanted to. It's not that hard. So go grab it and have a play is the message with that. How are we going time-wise? All right, five's probably ideal because this beautiful slide's through. This is our building in Canberra, by the way. And I'd like to say that the Heritage Listed Buildings gorgeous, and I'd like to say that I work there. Andy and I work in a concrete box 15 kilometres north of there, a concrete box that was designed as a repository for paper and not for people. Looks like some sort of post-war bunker type thing, but this is the public face. People get to see this and go, "Oh, isn't it lovely?" It is lovely. So what I would like to do very briefly is just show you Xena in operation. break the cardinal rule of don't work with children, animals or live software, and get it to do some simple stuff just so you can see what the GUI looks like. And this would be the Xena that you would arguably download if you were going to be pulling it off the web. Hey, go away. So here's the Xena Lite. We call this one Xena Lite because it doesn't implement every single feature of Xena. We trimmed it down a little bit so that it's just kind of a window into what Xena can possibly do. The full framework allows you to get every Xena feature linked into your application. So the main thing you do with Xena is you grab a file. So I'll add file through here. I'll just grab a text file. We'll open him up and we'll normalize it. So it's working out what it is and it's normalized it complete. So it says that it's guessed it as plain text. It's used the plain text normalizer. It said that it works, which makes me very happy. It's given it an output file name, which is using the NAA file naming wrapper, and that's our crazy NAA standard hashed file name, which takes the date, time, and the original file name and puts it into a hash and gives a string of incomprehensible garbage, but that's important to us. If you were doing it yourself, it would probably be something saner, like the original file name .xena or something like that. In fact, if you download the one off the web, the one off the web doesn't use the NAA file namer by default. You can dig in there and put it there if you were crazy, but you don't need to. So let's have a look at that. I can double click it now that it's finished, and the Xena Viewer opens up. And the Xena Viewer lets us have a look at some of the metadata associated with it and a MD5 checksum associated with the data object, which is just this text here. And this is the view that we call the NAA package view, which is just a NAA viewer doing its best to render what the original document was, or the original record was. The viewer lets us do a couple of other things as well. We can have a raw XML view, so we can see what really happened. That's what Xena really did to our plain text. Added a lot of XML, which is what it's all about. And if you want a slightly friendlier XML view, you can have an XML tree view, where you can step down through the levels of the tree and see all the same things and see what all the XML attribute names, etc. are. So it just gives you a choice of different ways of looking at it. Plain text file is probably the very simplest example. If people read that, it's probably unfair doing software things like this where you can't see the fine text. That's just telling them I'm cancelling it. It's just asking me if I want to delete that. Am I sure? Yes, I do. I don't care about that. I'm going to remove it from my file list, and I'm going to grab another one. And I'll grab an image this time, say a PNG image. Doesn't really matter what format. So I'll normalize that. It's guessed it as, okay, it's guessed it as being a PNG. It's going to use the PNG normalizer. Results in this, but I'll open it up in the viewer. And the viewer shows me the image. Whee, let's have a look. The zoom facility will let me fit it to the fit for size so we can have a look. Whee! I wish I knew where that came from. It's one of our long time test images. So it's showing us things like the zoom factor, it's showing us the metadata once again and the checksum there, and the same stuff exists here for the views that we could have had exactly the same as we had for the text document. So I'll pop that out of here, and that just gives you the brief idea of what it does. Now the interesting part in terms of Open Office, etc., is if we do the very same thing, let's highlight him and get rid of him. If we do the very same thing with a Microsoft Office document, so we'll grab this one and we'll open them up. This, I think, is a diagram of one of our racks in our repository that one of my colleagues saw fit to create in Microsoft Word. I've no idea why. If I was trying to create a drawing, it wouldn't be quite the first application I'd be thinking of. So we open this up, this Word document, which is mostly actually an image. I should say that it was detected as being a word processor type document, and it used the Office normalizer, which is mostly OpenOffice. Now, the Xena viewer is saying, oh my God, what have I got here? Okay, much to look at there. I've got the metadata for sure, and I've got the checksum. I can go into the raw XML view, and it will certainly give me that. I'll have to think about it for a moment, because I've got to spool it all into RAM. It doesn't look very big, except look where this bar is. Whee! That's ODF. That's ODF as base 64, and there's an awful lot of it. Not that we worry about that. Let's go back to the package view, because what I want to do is open it in openoffice.org, which is a much more sensible way of seeing what the original document was, and that's exactly what it looked like as a rack diagram. So the viewer harnesses OpenOffice for rendering stuff that the viewer doesn't feel comfortable with. The viewer is pretty good at fairly basic spreadsheets, ordinary text documents and things like that, but when it comes to something wacky like this, when some genius decides that .doc is ideal for drawings, the viewer says, please give me OpenOffice. And it pleases me no end that this is 2.1, installed last week, and everything just works. Lovely. And that's it. Yes, I've thought a lot about integrating ODF Viewer. To the extent that I've been bouncing back and forth with Daniel Carrera as the Linux versions particularly come out, because that interests me, I should mention that we use Linux, Mac OS and Windows in all our development. My personal interest leans in the Linux direction, and ODF Viewer is here, and we had a look at it. It's not what I'd call mature enough at this stage for doing what we want to do, but with the XUL runner and ODF Viewer giving us a potentially much lighter thing to do it than OpenOffice, that would be way cool. Certainly we look at that. We looked at the other implementation. We're interested to see once the whole KOffice thing and Qt 4 running on Windows, if KOffice Windows and if we get some cross-platformness out of that, we may use the KOffice code base for that part of it. Not fully decided. I mean, open document format, as far as we're concerned, is a long-term strategy. The implementation details don't matter. And I guess that's the other thing I should say. If we and our software are gone, records survive. If Xena is gone, if our viewer is gone, if all that stuff is gone, somewhere in the world, somebody has kept records of, we're keeping records of the formats, but if we get blown off the face of the earth and someone somewhere has some of our records, the open formats give us the best chance that someone can come along and say, oh, I see that, that's XML, that's ODF, I'll just write a viewer in Python. In fact, some people have suggested that you could implement all our software in 3 lines of Perl. maybe you could, but yeah, that's a fundamental thing.
Just to really impress us, would you like to open up your Xena again?
Yeah.
Change the extension on some file to some way out, and then run it through the normalizer.
It might even be. It might even be. I'm not sure what's in this test directory. Let's just see if there's one that doesn't even have Federated or fire extensions. Oh, this is cool. Do you have one? Here we go. I don't actually know what that is. That's a something. We'll fire him up. Actually, the other thing is the directory. You do a whole directory of files. Oh, that was boring. That's plain text. Okay, I'll fiddle. Let's have a look. Where am I? Where's my test data? Didn't I have a slash up? Yay. Okay, let's... Oh, it's capped. It's very hard to do sideways to a screen. Oh yeah, or JPEG. Oh, you can call it foo.jpg if you like. Can you remind me of what it was called beforehand when it comes time to do it? Did you write that special filter, Andy? Normalizing foo.jpg. Something happened. Hey, look at this. Hey, the office pen. Let's just go for broke here. Hold your breath. Down to three. Please show me something. Yes, it's a spreadsheet. Because it thinks it's an open office. It thinks it's an office document. And it is. And it lives. So there we are. So anyway, grab the Zenith software. Don't just play with it, but play with it and break it. And then let us know.
I would love to run this over my home directory and get all my old legacy files up to date to a current standard. Am I going to run into problems that, being an archive, you can probably get around with proprietary formats? Like, how open are the converters? Or is it like having to download DCCS from some Bulgarian website so I can actually use the thing?
Everything that's in the current Xena plugin is GPL. Everything that we have, except, I guess, for the LGPL bits that might be in OpenOffice. We actually don't distribute the source for OpenOffice anyway. We tell people where they can get that and separately install OpenOffice as a plugin. The bits that we provide inside our plugins in our own source tree, everything's GPL. Yes. So we don't at the moment work with any formats where there's anything illegal that we know of. I'm sure we would try not to. I guess we're kind of, with anything that originates from a Commonwealth government agency, we own it. And the government just tells anybody who says otherwise to go away, which makes it easy for us. But if you find an example of something that you would like to be able to convert, that we think we're capable of converting, please don't ask me about video until the end of the year, and we'll see. Yeah. But at the moment, everything's pretty good as far as I can tell. But the hard part is when you're a software development team and you're not a legal team, it's hard. It's hard to know what's best effort. Thank you all.